Hey, Tara Strong here, and you're listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 213 of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today, as usual, is the Comic Concierge. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. We are back at it once again, dealing with some more Alfred Hitchcock films. We've covered 8 of them so far, and this is number 9. This is going to be our coverage of the 1960 horror film entitled Psycho. As you can guess, produced and directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Otherwise, this wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. And the film stars Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, Vera Mills, John Gavin, Martin Balsam, and a few other folks. And as we usually start off these, we kind of briefly talk about our experience with the film. Dan, I know you mentioned last episode that you had seen the remake, I guess you would call it, the shot-for-shot remake that came out. Was that in the 90s or the 2000s?
It was the 90s. It was late 90s. I think 99, maybe. I forget the exact.
And that was your only experience with this movie, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I might have, like, I definitely haven't sat down to watch the entire thing before.
Okay. And what, without going into any, like, specific details, what was your opinion or your take on the 1999 film?
Yeah, 98 was that.
Okay. Or 98.
I know it was late 90s. I can't remember when. I don't know. It was fine. I was young and I didn't really understand context of it really. You know, I knew it was like a remake, but I didn't realize it was a shot for shot remake. So I enjoyed it. It did feel kind of odd because it's modern, you know, but also it does have that old timey feel, you know, so it was, I don't know. I know people hate it. Hated it, but obviously at the time I didn't have the comparison, so I didn't hate it. I remember enjoying it well enough, but clearly not enough to go back and watching the original. But I don't know how it would feel now going back, you know, comparing it to see.
Right. Yeah, I had no experience with this one. Had never seen it. Had really never been interested in seeing it. Like, this is one of the ones that, like, had we not been doing this, I don't know if I would have ever watched this film, just because the way it's billed as a horror film, and I'm just not like a horror film fan for the most part. So, like, generally I watch them if my wife wants to watch them because she loves horror films, but It's not stuff that I seek out on my own. And I probably would have just let that, like, the stereotype of what kind of film it was, maybe cloud my judgment of just watching it because it's a classic or watching it because it's a Hitchcock film or whatnot. But yeah, I had not only no experience with it, I had somehow, like, actually avoided all information about it. Like, I knew nothing had been spoiled for me on this film, which is kind of odd to say. Like, I knew there was a shower sequence, but outside of that, I knew nothing. None of the twists and turns had been, like, revealed to me. I hadn't stumbled across it or something like that. So somehow I guess I'd avoided talk about Psycho for my entire life. So I did appreciate the fact that I got to see it without anything being spoiled for me or known about in advance. So I will say that much. This one is based off of the 1959 novel of the same name. Like, a lot of the Hitchcock films we've talked about, typically based off of short stories, novels, plays, things of that nature. So you got to watch the original now, Dan. And before you get into your thoughts, I have a sneaky suspicion we've been somewhat in line with each other throughout this. I mean, there might have been some films that, like, you liked a little bit more than me, or I liked a little bit more than you, but we've generally been about pretty similar opinions on all of these films, and I have a feeling this may be a difference in opinions for the two of us, but I'm interested to see. So what was your take on the original version of this story, the 1960 Hitchcock film Psycho?
It's interesting that you say, like, you're able to watch this without being spoiled, because when I was watching this, I kind of felt like this had the similar thing to, like, Empire Strikes Back, in the sense of it's so ingrained in pop culture that can you actually experience it the way it was meant to be originally experienced, because a lot of it is designed to subvert your expectations. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's designed to subvert your expectations because, you know, at the time, know, the idea was that the story would follow Janet Leigh. It almost would be, and the first, I would say, hour or so is set up like it is more of that classic noir thriller, where, and if you go in not knowing anything, you know, you wouldn't. I think you're waiting to see, you know, what's happening next, in the sense of like this, you know, Norman Bates doesn't seem like it's going to be the main focus of the story, but then that all changes, and that, like, that is the big, huge surprise of the movie. And I, you know, like you mentioned, well, I guess you were able to avoid that, but it, like, that shower scene is so iconic and so well known, it's obviously the point where that's impossible, especially if you're like myself and watch the original or the remake before this. So I still really, despite all that, I still rather enjoyed the movie a great deal. I did like it does have that meshing of both noir as well as, you know, the horror aspects. To me, the person that, like, really shines in this, the person that makes the movie work, it is Anthony Perkins, Norman Bates. Like, he is so good in this. In this, like, you know, at first he does feel a little bit all shucks. He feels, you know, he's like, oh, this, he does seem like, you know, like a nice guy, basically, you know, this normal everyday guy, upstanding citizen. But then the way he's, like, able to slowly show you kind of the darker underneath elements of him, especially in that opening, you know, when he's having dinner with Marianne and they're talking about taxidermy and things like that. And, like, that psyche is kind of showing itself. And I don't know, I found his performance to be really captivating throughout. I will say the downside is I don't think anyone comes close to him. I think a lot of the other characters, especially after Janet Leigh exits, like, they're not nearly as strong performance-wise. Like, the other characters, I think you do lose some, but he's, you know, he of course is still there. But I thought it was very effective. I thought this, of course, it has, you know, one of the most iconic scores of all time. That, you know, the soundtrack of The Stabbing is, you know, one of the most imitated, you know, pieces of music outside of Jaws, probably. So I still rather liked it. I wouldn't put it looking at the best films we've watched thus far. I don't know if I would put it there. Like, I didn't have that. I wasn't as captivated with it as some of those other films, because, like I mentioned, I don't think the performances were strong throughout. And I think I don't think it loses something after that scene, but I do think, like, the climax, it's at its height within those moments. In the next 30, 45 minutes, it doesn't have that same, never captures that again, I don't think. But I don't know, I still really liked it. I still thought it was well made. I think the idea of being able to shoot it in black and white was the right choice. It helped, I think, really establish that atmosphere overall, but I'm getting the sense maybe that you felt the other way.
I'm still wrestling with it a bit. I feel like this may end up somewhat like in the same realm as Vertigo for me, in a way. Like, it's something that is very highly praised, right? Like, this film is on a lot of people's top lists. It's on a lot of, like, famous top 100 lists. A lot of people put this as even the number one Hitchcock film out there. So part of it may be that there was super high, pretty impressive resume of, like, it's lauded very well and all this type of stuff. So it's hard when you've heard so many, like, fantastic things about a film. Yeah. And when you go and watch it, you know, most films can't live up to that. Like, even if they are fantastic, like, it's just like you get such a high expectation and a high, like, thought process going. So, like, some of it I'm trying to wrestle with whether that's part of why I came away a little lower on it. Not low, like, as if it's a bad movie, but, like, in the similar way, like, what we talked about with Vertigo, where it's just like I don't quite see it hitting on as many levels as I expect when I'm hearing the praise that I hear. So that's one thing that I'm a little wrestling with. And the other thing that I'm wrestling with, which is 100% more on me than it is on the film, and I was thinking about this oddly as I was reading some other reviews from some other folks on Letterboxd as they were reviewing some older films, like from the 50s and whatnot, that I had Well, I'll just say it, for example. So, like, In Session Film just did a episode on My Fair Lady. And they're going through, I believe, all of the best picture winners and reviewing them. I don't know exactly if they're covering all of them or just certain ones or whatever. But they talked about My Fair Lady, and I read their reviews on Letterboxd, and they were both very low on it. And it caught me off guard a little bit. I'm a little bit biased because I got to perform in a version of My Fair Lady in like my college age years. And so I have a little bias going into it. But I was reading the reviews and thinking, well, you're seeing this in through the eyes of somebody in 2025 versus somebody that was watching it in the time period that it was made. And then I was like immediately thinking the same thing then with Psycho. I was like, is this fair because I'm viewing this through 2025 lens, not 1960? And it's hard when you've seen all of this done, because obviously this inspired a lot of other films to do similar things, right? Like there's a lot of stuff that has that little twist at the end, and there's like the whole, like, I don't know, like you think of like The Sixth Sense, and you think of like different things that have come out along the way, and like, so some of that steals some of that, because now I got 65 more years of movies that I've seen here and there. Not that I've seen everything, but I've seen a few. So it's like now trying to like take that away and take that knowledge of all the different films that Psycho influenced and view it as it was, which is something that really kind of broke a mold in a way and almost created a whole genre. Like a lot of people give this credit for, like introducing or being one of the first like slasher films in a way, or what leads to a lot of those. So it, some of it's like wrestling with my own perspectives versus like what the film is, and I'm still kind of coming to terms with that. Another thing that I was like a little bit debating with myself is like, this is, it's listed as a horror film, it's known as a horror film, but I'm having like these discussions with myself, like in my head, on what separates this from all of the other films that we've watched it outside of that it's a little bit more like that it shows a little bit more. But in many ways, like you said, like the first whole half of this or anything just lines up with a lot of the other stuff we've seen as far as the thriller suspense, like noir aspect.
Yeah.
But this one gets 100% like described and portrayed as, you know, an all out horror film. And I don't know enough about horror films. So I don't know if it's just the fact that the shower sequence is here, or that they show a little bit more of that, that it's a little bit more graphic, that makes it a horror film, because otherwise you're dealing with a lot of the same aspects, right? Except I guess in this situation, instead of the killers that we've seen in like almost every other film we've watched so far, because almost all of them, have all of them had a killer? All of them have had a murder, right?
Well, Notorious didn't really, Notorious was more the,
there was some implied.
Yeah. Like some people got killed, but it wasn't
right,
like,
right.
Yeah. So
like they've all had a or most of them have had like a murder or a killing of some sort, but they just deal with it in a much more subtle way, I guess, in some situations where it's implied or where we don't necessarily see it 100% of the time. So I guess that's the difference, but I don't know enough about like genre studies to figure out like which things make this one a horror film. That's, you may more know more about that.
I know it's a good question, because it, like, I guess it's the idea of like horror versus thriller. Where does it? I think it's more so labeled as a horror because, as you mentioned, the influence of like, of what it led to. Because, you know, then the motels. I don't know if this was the first movie like this to have a motel scene of this nature. There may have been others, but clearly it helped popularize it. And then we got more and more of it. And then maybe because the like, the murder becomes the central story. It, you know, it becomes like kind of the focus. It is designed to scare. Like that is like where I think that becomes like where.
I get that.
Where other movies like Vertigo certainly was an element there, but that like there was much romance as thrills, I guess. I don't know. I think it's a fine line. I think you could even say, you know, Vertigo certainly has horror elements. Like North by Northwest, perhaps not, but it's like where there's a thriller end and a horror began, I guess it's
right.
Always
good. That had nothing to do with my like opinion about the film. It was just something that I was thinking about, that was like, you know, back in this time period, if this is like one of the first ones of its kind. I was curious, like, how that evolves. And, like, I get it, like, maybe in some situations you have the jump scares, right? You have a soundtrack that's, like, a little bit different. It's trying to influence those scares a little bit. Like you said, it, you know, you can see the influence that this has on Jaws and things like that, where, like, you have that soundtrack that's really amplifying the scares a little bit as well. And then I guess perhaps to, like, the motivations of the person involved in the killing or the murders, maybe that's like where you could draw a line to. Not that everybody's not a little bit off if they're killing somebody, but, like, you know, this situation, obviously there's more to this character that's putting him in the position that he's in. So I kind of get that a little bit as well.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this kind of did for Showers what Jaws did for Going to the Ocean. You know, it played against, you know, those fears. I don't know if it necessarily created them, but certainly, like, that, those places where you feel the most vulnerable, and something, you know, I'm sure everyone's had that moment where they heard something outside of a shower and then, like, quickly opened the curtain just to see what exactly was there. So I think it was
very, I did read something that said Janet Leigh didn't take showers again during her lifetime after this.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because of, like, anything besides, I think she said while she was watching the film after it was done, or at one point she was watching it, and it was more so the fact that it kind of hit home for her that, like, how vulnerable you are in the shower.
Yeah.
As far as that goes. And I don't know if it's true or not. It said that she didn't take it. Like, she swore off showers for the rest of her life and just took baths. But then I read something else that somebody else had been, wrote, I don't know if he wrote Hitchcock or wrote somebody or put it in a review or something, that, like, they were mad because their daughter was already afraid of baths because of some other film that had come out around this time. And then this one made the daughter afraid of showers. So he was like, no,
I can't wait.
And Hitchcock said something about, like, we'll send her to the dry cleaners or something.
You have to go out back with a hose.
Go ahead.
Speaking of, since we're talking with the shower scene, I couldn't remember this, if this was done in the remake or not, but, like, I was impressed with how that shower scene happens, and I was waiting for it to kind of cut. But, like, it stays, like, after that happens,
mm-hmm.
you know, we stay there, you see Norman come down, kind of go through it, and, you know, I think that's where I was thinking about, like, the mindset of not knowing, because I knew, obviously, the twist or whatever. Did you know that at that point, or did you not know about?
I did not know, I hadn't put it all together, I don't think, at that point. I think I was so distracted by the fact that it happened so early in the film.
Okay.
So I was not anticipating the shower. I thought the shower scene was going to be something at the end. Like, I thought that was going to be like leading up to the final climax and things like that. And it happens, like, less than halfway in, or at the halfway. I don't know where you're at it technically minute wise, like, but it feels like almost halfway through. Yeah. And I was just like, wait, what? I'm like, she's not going to be in the rest of the film. Like, what are we doing here? I thought this was her film. I thought this was, like, we just spent, like, half the movie building up this character, learning about her and all this other stuff. And I think that kind of led me to some of the same feelings that you had, that, like, once she was gone, I was like, okay, like, who do I care about now? It's like watching a Game of Thrones season and being like, well, everybody I cared about just died in that season. So do I need to come back for season two? I don't know.
Yeah. I could get that. I think what kept me, one, like I said, I thought Anthony Perkins was really good, and I was just interested to see, like, them being able to go back and see if they could actually, I mean, figure out what
exactly. I don't think I would have ever put all the pieces together, and it's maybe one of the quibbles I have with the film is the fact that there's certain things that I don't know if it's because of how they do the voice of, we'll call her Mrs. Bates. Again, I don't think you can spoil this movie. It's 65 years old, but and I'm the only one that didn't know what was going to happen. So, like, I think we're good then, but, like, they used females to do that voice. And so I'm too, like, I guess maybe I'm too practical or logical or something in my brain. So I would have never, like, it was clearly a woman's voice. It wasn't a man throwing his voice to sound like a woman, even if it would have been like a really good job of it. So like, I don't think I would have ever been able to put those two together because I'd already like, it wouldn't have fit my other pieces of logic I have in my head going there. And then I really need to rewatch the film because I thought I was paying really close attention to a sequence where he's taking his mother down the stairs. Mm-hmm. And they must have done a phenomenal job filming that sequence because I was like looking to see if it was real or not. Cause I thought different things. And like, then they would do something in the film that I was like, oh, well that eliminates that thought, when it actually didn't. So like they did enough to keep me guessing throughout that. And like the voice, like I said, would have thrown me off. And then I looked up afterwards. I was like, well, who's doing the voice of this? And they cast three different people to do her voice, which is also interesting. So like throughout the film, there's two female and one male that does her voice. So apparently there is a point where a male is throwing his voice, but it sounded so much like a female to me that I was just thrown off by that a little bit. So I definitely wouldn't have predicted it happening until obviously there's more clues along the way that sort of reveal it. But yeah, that was interesting. And the other thing I was interested or kind of thrown off at the beginning, number one was the shower sequence happening so soon. And number two was, and Amanda leaned over to me about 5 minutes in and she's like, she was convinced that that we weren't going in chronological order anymore because they had gone back to black and white. And I was trying to figure out what the reasoning for it was, why they were doing it. Because obviously we had just had a color film in the last couple and then they go back to black and white. And I was interested to see like why that was. I read a couple different things. I don't know which one's more true. Like one of them said that they had to do it because of the graphic nature of the film and making it in black and white made it not quite as gory. But then I also read something that Hitchcock was just using black and white because he was trying to make this film as cheaply as possible or as inexpensive as possible because he was afraid that it wasn't going to make very much money because of the nature of the film. So I don't know which one, maybe both had an influence, but I do think it works as black and white.
Yeah. Yeah,
for sure.
I think it is a better movie because of it in a lot of ways. Cause it, I think, especially like the Bates' house, it just looks that much more creepy. Mm-hmm. And I think the mom, of course, like even being able to, I think you can hide it a little bit more for longer with it being in black and white. Like if it's in color, I think it comes off a little, you can maybe tell, or it's a little bit more obvious, but yeah, it's,
I do agree with you though, that the characters in the first half are there's more to them and they're more likable to me. Like not, I don't know if likable is the right word, but in the beginning, obviously we get her and her lover and we have her boss, her coworker, and then the idiot guy that is coming in to try to like make some type of deal with her boss. But like they all have some like character to them. Like obviously we get Hitchcock's daughter again as the coworker in that first office sequence or whatever, the same person that we saw in which one was it, Strangers on a Train? Or yes, Strangers on a Train. So we get to see her again. Like I was much more invested in all of those characters, and obviously Norman Bates is enough to carry the rest of the film. I'm not saying he's not. Like it's interesting to watch. There's enough intrigue there that you're trying to figure out what's behind everything and all the elements of this, and he's enough to carry it. But I did find like that second half, like her sister, I could care less about her. I guess, to be perfectly blunt, and like the guy becomes less interesting, her lover that was, I mean, he was never real interesting, but like just the fact that we're left with those two in a way was kind of, it left a little bit for me to desire because I was hoping that there would be some more little fun pieces along the way as we're kind of, I wanted more interaction with Bates from these other characters, but like I said, Norman Bates is phenomenal. He carries this well. I can't picture anybody else playing that role.
Yeah.
Which you feel bad because like for the rest of his career, that's all anybody's going to be able to like view him as, which you can either accept that or you can let that like get to you. But I do think he was phenomenal, like you said.
Yeah. I think at that point, it's like those characters are just lots of vices purposely, like where they're just there to try to let you figure out what exactly is happening in the push the mystery forward a bit. And maybe in the novel, they're able to kind of go deeper into it and stuff like that. But yeah, it's interesting too, because, like, you know, obviously this all stems from her stealing $40,000, and it had me thinking, like, how much is that in today's money? And I don't know how accurate this calculation is, but it was like $429,000 would be how much it is today, which is kind of just.
And then it would also be interesting to know, like, that there was that in that car interaction, like, how much that, like,
yeah,
equated to, because they're definitely throwing around some different money. And it was interesting too, like, they have this big plot moment as far as her taking off with that money, and I still feel like that's not fleshed out 100%. Like, it seems really odd at first, like, her decision making and, like, what she's doing with that. And I was interested to try to, like, get to see more about some underlying factors. I know they do have some conversations between her and Norman Bates that kind of go to it, and obviously, like, she decides that she's not doing the right thing at one point. And there's a whole redemption sequence, which is, you know, symbolic with her taking the shower and all the other stuff. But, like, there was a few moments that I was like, oh, I want to see a little bit more. I want to get, like, when she first steals it, I'm like, I'm not buying that this character is doing this at first. Which was kind of a little tricky. And then there was another thing that I wish they would have fleshed out a little bit more, which was, and I don't know how they do this. You really can't, because you're going to have this big reveal at the end, this big twist, et cetera, which even for me not knowing the movie or anything like that, I think there was enough breadcrumbs there that it wasn't very shocking. I've seen too many movies that do similar stuff, so you can kind of predict it. In 1960, I'm sure it was that would have been a lot harder to do, but in 2025, like, we've seen that. So I kind of put that together. But then after that, it's kind of a weird sequence where there's just a dialogue. There's like a dump of information, like a narrative dump, between at the police station or wherever it is, that I wish there would have been a way for them to do that without just, I don't know. Like, when that happens in today's films, critics are all over it. Like, they're usually very much against those types of things where we just get a narrative dump like that. I guess it's okay in Psycho because it's a classic that they do that. But I also don't know how they would have avoided it, because you're basically at the end of the film, so you have to explain things somewhat quickly. But it did come off like, oh, we're getting a whole bunch of information right now to, like, tie up all the loose ends in a nice bow. And I wasn't sure how that worked for me in a way.
Yeah, I could see that. I think also a lot of that too is, I think the idea of psychology is so probably unknown for a lot of people at that time, at that level. Yeah. But you had it, like, the way that you approach it. It's interesting. Did you ever, so I know this is based off a book, but a lot of this is based upon a real life story of Eddie, I think it's Eddie Gein, how you pronounce it. Have you ever heard? So I actually read, there's this really great comic. Do You Know What Eddie Gein Did? And goes into, like, his story. And it's interesting, like, watching that, because a lot of that real life story is what inspires this. It's what inspires Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Silence of the Lambs. They all kind of come from a similar vein. So I do think, when you mentioned, like, how a lot of movies, like, you know, like, you were able to put together, you know, because you've seen a lot of movies.
Right.
I think a lot of that, too, is because a lot of them at the core is, like, the same real life story that they're all kind of breaking off from. So I think that is also part of that. At this time, like, that story,
right,
I'm not sure when exactly it was, but it wasn't that far away from when this movie came out. So it was, you know, far more new. Like, it was still
And I think the other thing too is not just movies, it's like the type of TV we've had in the last, I don't know, let's call it 20 years, 25 years, maybe even 30, with all the different Criminal Minds and CSIs and NCISs and Law and Orders and all that kind of stuff. Like, I feel like each one of them has done this as well in some way, shape, or form. So it's like, you're not just getting it in movie form, we've been getting it in all the, like, the crime drama TV series as well. Yeah. Like at some point, like there's little tiny twists like this. So like, I don't think that helps either. That's why like I'm really trying to like view this and take like the 2025 like lenses off, but it's really hard to do.
I get that. Also, though, I do think it's also like it being Hitchcock. There are some like amazing shots in this, like the shot of him when he takes a looks through the wall into her room, like that. Like that's pretty incredible. After, and, you know, of course, you have the like iconic shower scene, but then like after that, like how he goes through the room and like like that entire sequence, like it goes out of the, that's like incredible for the time. So
it does feel like they're doing something similar that they do with, I guess you could, the film that would most represent it that we've talked about would be Rear Window, where it is in a way putting you in that character's perspective, I guess, for lack of a better term. Like it's literally like you're watching through the eyes of Norman Bates at one point, so it's almost forcing you to be also spying on her or looking in or doing all of that stuff. So I think it's an interesting thing that Hitchcock does occasionally, at least that we've seen, where he's making the viewer almost part of the film, but more so like in a character's view and like in their perspective in a way that you feel like you're doing something wrong also, which I think is a very genius move by him.
This like, this entire film is like, dedicated to the taboo. Like the opening scene is of oh my goodness, so I had to forget her name.
Janet Leigh.
Janet Leigh. Open scene is Janet Leigh, like in her underwear, which
which is also on the movie poster.
Which is on the movie poster, which, you know, certainly is something that is unbecoming for and I mean it was a 60s, so maybe, you know, it was starting to loosen up a little bit, but still. And like, and of course, looking into the shower, it is, they have a relationship. They're not married. So I think this is an exercise. Like he loves to revel in the taboo. And I think this is kind of escalates that further and further from that opening moment to like all these different, aspects of like, you know, the, what is considered indecent, to the point we're having,
right.
You know, the idea of, I mean, being a transvestite, which is said in this movie, of course, which is obviously, it means a lot of different things now, but it's just like, it's just interesting. Like
it's interesting that he got it made.
Yeah. Especially it's kind of crazy that there wasn't a bigger, maybe there was, and we just didn't know about it, but like, I feel like there's a lot of things here that could cause a gigantic uprising considering everything involved. But,
and it seems like the biggest thing that, so you have like the shower sequence, you have the stabbing, you have the lack of, you know, it's not, nobody's nude or things like, or it's not shown, but like, you know, you have allusions to it. You have scantily clad, you know, a woman in the first sequence. You have all these other things that you think that someone would have a problem with. And yet the biggest thing that they had to try to get around to allow it to be filmed was the flushing of a toilet. Like that seems bizarre. I mean, I guess this is the first time that a toilet's flushed on an American film.
And oh, really?
Yeah, like literally. And I guess it was a thing, like somebody involved, it wasn't Hitchcock, but somebody involved, I think in the screenplay, whoever was the writer, possibly Joseph Stefano, for some reason wanted to flush a toilet on the film and get past this rule that you couldn't do that, and was in conversation with Hitchcock, like, I want to flush a toilet on a film. And Hitchcock's like, well, then you better write it in so that it makes sense. And that's why they have the whole sequence where she tears up everything and on these numbers and throws it in there. And like, he had to do it in a way that was so important to the plot that they couldn't cut it, because I mean, not that it was so important, but something that was like, you know, relevant to the plot, where they can't just be like, we'll take that sequence out. So like, yeah, it's the first time a toilet's flush, and that's the thing that had to get past the censors, not the not any of the other stuff, which is interesting. Also find it interesting, like how much Hitchcock was, and it seems like a lost art, right? Like these days everything gets spoiled for you. Like nothing can happen on anything without it being like told you in advance or thing. Like I think of like even outside of the film world, like just, now I know not everybody's into professional wrestling, but like professional wrestling is like a perfect example of where we're at today with like the internet and everything and how many people are involved. Like almost nothing is ever a surprise, right? Like it's very hard for them to keep something under wraps and make something like a legit shock or surprise, because people are like making their livings out of exposing that stuff. And yeah. So he was very put a concerted effort to try to avoid people knowing how this was going to end. So he bought the rights to this book kind of on the down low, or kind of like somewhat subtly, and then apparently went out and tried to buy as many copies of the book as possible to prevent more copies being out that someone could read and find out how this is going to end. Like that seems like maddening. Like there's no way you could buy all of the copies of this book and prevent anybody from knowing. But like he made an effort to try to do that, to try to prevent people from knowing how it was going to end. And then he also did something that ends up being somewhat impactful, I guess, from the movie theater business, is he made movie theaters sign a contract that if they were showing this film, that nobody could go into the film if they were late to the start of the show.
Yeah.
So like, and like before this, like movie theaters would just show a movie on loop and it would just be playing like all day, and people would come in at different times. Like sometimes you'd come in halfway through, sometimes you'd come in like whatever, and you'd catch what you could and stuff like that. And like, this is probably a piece to the puzzle that leads to, I mean, it probably would have happened for other reasons and different stuff, but this helps escalate the process of actual having start times where you pay for a predetermined time. Not just you go up and pay your ticket and get to go into the theater and see what's playing. Like you had to buy, you know, like we do now, a 7:20 showing or an 8:20 showing. But, and then he had like big signs made, put in the theaters that were like, if you try to like come to this movie after it started, like we're going to remove you with force and stuff like that. Or I don't know. I don't know exactly what it said, but it was like literally a quote from Hitchcock that was like, don't do this. I want the theater people to make sure that you can't go in halfway through. Yeah. And part of that's too, because of the fact that he knows how much happens in the first little bit or first half or whatever. And that if you come in and miss some of that, like it's going to change the viewing and whatnot. So it was very interesting about how secretive he was about the ending coming out and things of that nature. At least I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is, I heard that before regarding it helped establish movie times, which to me is just crazy when you think, like, I couldn't imagine just like going to the theater and then,
it does make more sense though, because when you see things that are like showing old time films and like somebody will like be on the run or something, and they just hop into a theater that like half the people are already in, and you can tell the movie's already started, and you're like, wait, this isn't normal, but apparently it was.
Plus, I guess at the time, like they also would have film, you know, they would do the cartoons and they would do the news and stuff like that too. So I guess it makes sense, but still, just like, I couldn't, you know, now it's like you not only do you have the movie times, but you get your, you know, what seat you're at before you even leave the theater.
Right.
But, you know, I remember that, you know, we're old enough to remember if you wanted to see a movie opening weekend, you had to get there early
and just stand in the line.
Yeah. I remember doing that for like
camp out.
Yeah. Spider-Man, all those and whatnot. But
definitely did that for a few Star Wars films.
But anything else you had that you wanted to?
The film was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actress, I believe score or cinematography or something. Like the other two were more on that side of the things. I didn't realize until doing some more like research in the last like couple weeks since we've been doing this that Hitchcock never won a Best Director for anything.
Which is crazy.
Seems like a crime against humanity there, but he at least got nominated for this one. I don't know which film beat him out in this specific. Let's see. This would have been the 33rd Academy Awards. Who won Best Director? Billy Wilder won for The Apartment.
Apartment's a great movie. I would actually go Apartment over Psycho personally.
Yeah. So, but it's weird that he never won one. But yeah. So, like I said, I'm a little bit, probably not as high on this one as everybody else. I was checking out like the people that I'm connected to on Letterboxd, and literally every single person rates it either a 4.5 or a 5-star. I didn't find a single person that rated it anything lower than that. So I'm probably in the minority, but I think some of that's just because it's just really hard for me to view this. I think if I saw this in 1960, it probably would have been very impactful and very effective, and I would probably have a lot more high things to say about it. There's something about the second half characters that are a little bit of a miss for me. And I don't know. Like, Norman Bates is amazing. Like, I get how impactful this is for not just like we're talking about with the theater going process, but with all of the horror genre as we go forward. I see all of that and I appreciate all that. I don't think this is a bad movie in any way whatsoever. I just came in with probably too high of expectations would be like my overall thought. What about you?
Yeah, as I mentioned, looking at the Hitchcock films we've done so far, it's not up there as my favorite, but I still really enjoyed it. I still think it's well done, and there's a lot. I was really impressed by it, starting with the ambition of it, when you include the importance. And I could understand, like you mentioned, because it's a thing where a lot of what this does well is so old hat by now. So it's hard to, especially with horror, when it's horror so dependent upon concept of fear, you don't have that because like you're kind of ahead of the film. It's, you know, and especially for if it doesn't have another thing for you to be invested in, I could see where that is. But I like, even with my issues with, you know, the characters in the second half, everything I've ended up liking beyond that, like I said, this, it's so well crafted. And I find it is, there's even like, we didn't talk about, but there are so many great lines in this. There's so many that become really well known. You know, of course, the line regarding, you know, the best friend is a mother and all that stuff. Of
course, yeah, absolutely.
I say that and I can't remember the line.
But, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. So my
brain is broken, but but I and like I said, I think that is partially too. Like it's interesting just. It's a movie that is just as fascinating regarding everything surrounding it. And then also just learning about like the real life story that inspired it and seeing, I think that honestly makes it even more impactful because you realize there's a lot of truth in what's happening here. Like it's not the Eddie Gein thing. It's very different, but it does involve a lot of what's brought up in this, like in the sense of like, I don't even want to get into it. it's not that far off. So I think that like knowing that piece, like it almost makes it even more impactful because it's like, oh yeah, like this actually is closer to reality than we like to know. So yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say that made me think one other thing too is like, and I would need to be a psychologist or somebody to like be better spoken when it comes to this type of thing, but I did think that the explanation of what's happening and what the real situation is once all the curtains pulled back, I still question how that connects and like works or how you reconcile that with the final murder attempt in this film, because it truly seems as if the character knows that they're about to be caught and then runs over to the house and does something very like, I feel like that last sequence of the actual last murder attempt doesn't line up with the psychology that would have been that they're trying to say is present. Like, but I don't know enough about that world to say that 100%, but I did question, yeah. Like, it's like when someone's trying to like put on a defense or build a defense of being not mentally sane to be, you know, to be culpable of their actions, and then you can see that they're doing stuff that proves that they're sane. Like there's something in that didn't 100% work for me. But like I said, I'm not knowledgeable enough in that arena to say that's for sure, but it did seem kind of jarring because I'm like, no, now he's clearly being a character that's doing this because he knows that something like the jig is up and he's just putting on a costume and doing this, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't like there wasn't enough time for him to transition into another personality, so to speak. I don't know. That's just me being overly critical, though. I did. Well, you can continue your thoughts, but then I guess we forgot too to like point out any of the Hitchcock-isms that we saw in this film as well.
Yeah. One of the things I was going to ask if you had any interest in, I didn't even realize that there are sequels to this. Not, there's like the second and third film.
And he's in it, right? Like,
yeah, it picks up like in real time afterwards, after Norman.
That would be interesting.
So I would, yeah, I've never watched it. And you don't really hear anyone ever talk about it. So
we might have to have like a appendix after this. we're gonna have enough content, Dan, for the next couple of years. Like, we're just gonna keep expanding this series, even though those aren't obviously directed by Hitchcock. But I would be intrigued, at least in the second one, how good or bad that one is would probably influence if I wanted to watch the third one. But I definitely think it would be interesting. What other Hitchcock things did you pick out that we've talked about throughout this series?
Well, you know, of course, at the Hitchcock Blondes, this didn't have someone, you know, I guess maybe
for a brief moment.
Didn't have someone that was wrongly accused. Although I guess you could say like her sister maybe, but not really.
Well, they tried to for her lover. I can't remember the character's name, which is terrible, but her lover, like for a split second, but then it's pretty much put to bed after that. So they at least touch on it, I guess, for a second.
Yeah. But I'm trying to think if he had a cameo in this, but I can't remember.
He does. He does. I have to watch it again because I didn't catch it, but I read that he has a cameo super early on. And he said he intentionally did it like real close to the beginning of the film because he didn't want, I guess at this point it had been such a known thing that like some people would be like distracted by the film to watch to try to find his cameo, and he didn't want anybody to be like thinking about anything else throughout the rest of the film. So because of the twists and the turns and stuff like that, so he put it real early on, but I don't remember where it happens, but it is in there. I'll have to like rewatch part of the first part of the film to see that. And then obviously we do have the son mom relationship.
Oh yeah, definitely probably the most iconic of them all.
Yeah. And then there is some of the mystery elements as far as what's going to happen there. We don't necessarily have a small, like a one room set or a one state, you know, like a stage set or whatever, where it's all confined into a small space, but it is still mostly happening at this hotel.
Yeah.
So like you do have some other spots you go to, obviously, like there's a half a dozen probably, but you do mainly focus on the hotel, and you do have, at least for the whole second half, a pretty limited cast. So I think that kind of plays into some of the things that we've seen as well. I don't know if I picked up on anything else. Did you?
No, that's all I could really. There wasn't any, I guess, the trinket in the sense of, you know, that like Yost has that little small item. Mm-hmm. And she had that note, like there's the thing she wrote down, and like the newspaper with the envelope that becomes like a huge, you know, but eventually.
I mean, the money almost, really, I guess.
Yeah. But almost like he used that as a red herring because it makes you think, like, oh, that's the most important thing. But halfway through, that money is, I mean, it's still important to the story, but it's like it's not no longer the story. So
I do think
like he was really smart in this, and like he knew what people expected and was able to really use that in smart ways to subvert expectations.
It is interesting then that we go from North by Northwest, which you could say like almost influenced an entire genre of James Bond and those types of films, and then you have Psycho, which you could say, you know, influences the entire slasher genre that would come to be seen in the horror genre. So it's interesting how much impact you can see some of these films having, which I wasn't necessarily aware of before we started this journey. So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah. I've seen that like people ask like, what is like the best, you know, three movies, like, you know, who's had like, you know, three movie sequences or whatever you want to say. And like Vertigo, North by Northwest, and then Psycho. I mean, Suspicion, oh, that's a TV series, or The Wrong Man, which is, I have not seen, so I can't say that, but Vertigo, North by Northwest, and then Psycho, like, that's hard to beat those three, like, even though we didn't love Vertigo, but still, like, that's, it's, like, hard to beat that three with any type of films after that, so.
No, I totally get that. So, That's Psycho, the 1960 film. We still have one more in what I guess we could call is the first half of our Hitchcock series, because we have decided based on some conversations that we've had off of line, and you could have kind of picked up on the, I don't know if it was the last episode or the one before, where we kind of mentioned that we weren't tired of Hitchcock yet. So we have decided to expand this series. So we're going to be doing a number of other films as well. We haven't 100% narrowed down the exact number, but there's a good chance that this is right around the halfway point of this. We might do a couple different episodes in between the two halves, but we're gonna charter through some more Hitchcock waters. But the last one we have for this part of it, this first half, the original lineup, is 1963's The Birds. Dan, what is your experience with The Birds?
I have no experience with The Birds. I have seen Birdemic, of course.
and Sharknado.
I have not seen Sharknado.
Oh, okay.
No, I have avoided that. I saw Birdemic. It was one of those, like, watch awful, like, you know, with friends and laugh at it. But I've never seen The Birds. Honestly, I've heard mostly of all the movies we've done so far, The Birds is the one I've heard the most mixed reaction to. Like, I've heard a lot of people who don't like The Birds. So I'm curious with that going into it, like how I end up enjoying it.
I'm intrigued too. I know nothing about it. It's another one that I've completely blind spot to. So I've been interested in watching this one for sure. I don't know exactly what angle we go to with this one, but I know that I am a fan of other films that, whether they're campy or cheesy or whatever, when there's a lot of a certain type of animal or insect or something like that, like I like those types of like setups. So we'll see if that works with The Birds or not.
Like Them? Have you seen Them?
I haven't seen Them, but it reminds me of an episode of MacGyver that killer ants try to take over, and he has to figure out how to survive in this remote wilderness that everybody's getting killed by ants.
Nice, yeah. If you love like cheesy sci-fi, Them is great. It's I think honestly pretty good for its time, but it is that, you know, that is it is very much of its time.
Awesome. So if you want to keep up and ask us questions or keep track of what we're doing outside of our Hitchcock retrospective, there's a bunch of different ways you can do that. First, you can search out the show, which is I should know the name of the show, which is The Cinema Geeks, and you can search our handle out on Twitter, Facebook, etc., or the website that most of our stuff is held and housed in, which is the Geekcast Radio Network. You can search out all that kind of stuff. If you have specific questions or comments for either of the two of us, Dan, how can people reach out to you?
I am Comic Concierge on pretty much all social media platforms.
And I am at Optimus Solo on a few of them, not nearly as many as Dan is, because I'm just a slacker, but you can reach out to us there as well. If not, for sure tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks as we go one more step into the Alfred Hitchcock filmography with 1963's The Birds.